Much for the invitation, and I want to thank Reem for putting everything together. So our topic for today is ethical accounting for shareholders, and more specifically, the topic of what I've learned is called creative accounting. Just the same disclaimer that I gave last time, you know, I'm not an accountant, so I don't know so much about accounting, so I did some research online, you know, and learned a little bit, but I'm sure everyone here knows much more than I do about this, so I'm not coming to say anything halacha l'maaseh, you know, definitive halacha. I'm here to present some sources, you know, and we'll learn together, and I'm sure you know much better than I do, you know, how this would apply, you know, in the ins and outs of accounting. So beginning here from source one. This is from an article that I found, Accounting Ethics in the Traditional Jewish Perspective, by Gordon Cohn. So he writes, Chief Justice Berger, who was a chief justice in the U.S. from 1969 to 1986, Chief Justice Berger has expressed a similar view of the auditor's responsibility to ensure accurate reporting. By certifying the public reports that collectively depict a corporation's financial status, the independent auditor assumes a public responsibility transcending any employment relationship with the client. The independent public accountant performing the special function owes ultimate allegiance to the corporation's creditors and stockholders, as well as to the investing public. This public watchdog function demands that the accountant maintain total independence from the client at all times and requires complete fidelity and public trust. So we see that ethical accounting, I mean, as we knew already, is extremely important, and that the responsibility is not only to the client, but the responsibility is also to the investing public to make sure that they know, you know, what they're buying shares in and how the company is doing. So I saw a definition online for examples of creative accounting here in Source 2. And some of the examples they gave of this practice is, and creative, by the way, normally has a positive connotation, but from my understanding, the way it's used here, it has more of a negative connotation. I guess you know a lot better than I do about how this is used, but it says here, invoicing is a company may send its client an invoice before the end of the accounting period, but deliver after that period. So that first period will subsequently get a boost in sales and profit. It'll look like they earned more the first period where they were, you know, charging for what they were going to sell, and they only gave over the merchandise in the second period. Or in cases of service contracts. Imagine a company that services central heating systems has service contracts with customers. The company will typically charge the amount payable on the contract to customers before carrying out the work. Let's suppose the accountant posts the amount the company charges the customers in the first quarter of the year. However, he records the work taking place in the second quarter. The accounts for the first quarter will show a profit because there are no costs. However, the second quarter will show a loss because there are costs but no income. What happens if you only see the accounts for the first quarter? You will get an unrealistic view of how the company is doing. Or property values. You should include the value of a property in the balance sheet according to its purchase price. However, accountants can legitimately revalue the property so that the amount is greater. In other words, the amount in the balance sheet increases. The accountant can distort the company's apparent financial health by being over-optimistic with the property's reevaluation. Or loans, the company might lend money to somebody connected to the business. There may be some attempt to hide the transaction from people who read the accounts. One way is to set things up so that the borrower repaid the loan just before the end of the period. Then a new loan for the same amount appears at the beginning of the next period. So these are examples of where someone can do something, none of which are, so to speak, you know, actively dishonest, but they are misleading. And I'm sure that there are more examples of this. This is what I found online. But so these are some examples of cases like this, where you can present something without, you know, deviating from the truth, but it's not giving the exact picture, you know, that someone buying shares in the company might want to know. So,
what? Point of clarification.
Yes.
You are required to value assets, fair value of IFRS, and not the cost.
Oh, okay. So that's the law you're saying. So I guess there could be different ways in terms of assessing what the fair value is. I mean, you know much better than I do. But So then assess the value the way the law requires it. Fine. So let's look at some of the sources that discuss the Torah prohibition of Gnevas Das. Gnevas Das means deception. And it's referring to a case where a person is not actively stealing, but they're presenting a picture which is different than things actually are. So the Gemara tells us in Maseches Chulin, here at source 3, and I guess we'll just do the English for the sake of time, that it's forbidden to deceive all people, including idolaters. So everyone's included. We have to be honest towards everyone. So is this a biblical requirement, or is this a rabbinic requirement? So the Ritva says on that Gemara, the prohibition to deceive anyone is a biblical prohibition that is derived from the verse, "You shall not steal or deny." So just like we're not allowed to steal, we're also not allowed to deceive. So according to the Ritva, that's a biblical requirement. And the Prisha in the next source, in source 5, also understands that it's a biblical requirement, although he adds an additional verse as an additional source. He says, "One violates the negative commandments of, when selling, do not overcharge or underpay." In Hebrew, that's known as onna'a, that when a person sells something, they have to make sure that the price is accurate or within a sixth of the accurate price. If a person either underpays by more than a sixth or overcharges by more than a sixth, so that's this violation of what's called onna'a. And the Torah warns us not to trick or deceive. This is in addition to the negative commandment prohibiting theft. So the Ritva had said that one violates the prohibition of theft, of stealing, and the Prisha includes that whenever one deceives, they're also in violation of the law against onna'a. In a similar way, the Shulchan Aruch says it is forbidden to trick one's friend with measurements, and one who does so violates the prohibition of do not cheat with measures in addition to the prohibition of stealing. So when a person takes advantage of someone financially, we see this is as a precedent that one can be in violation of multiple different requirements. First of all, not to steal, and second of all, not to overcharge or not to underpay. In our context, I guess we're talking about not overcharging. So according to both the Ritva and the Prisha, this is biblical, yes.
Now, would this also be under the commandment, don't put a stumbling block in front of the blind person? Because if you're cheating with your weight, like you're being deceptive, and that's like a stumbling block.
Mm-hmm. So who is one causing, one's causing the buyer to stumble, you're suggesting, by,
Well, they're not aware of the true value.
Right.
So it's like putting a stumbling block in front of the blind person, someone who's
I hear that. What's interesting is that when the Torah says don't put a stumbling block in front of someone who's blind, so there's actually a question whether literally putting a stumbling block in front of someone who's blind is considered to be a violation of that verse. In other words, the way that Chazal understood that verse is you shouldn't give a person misleading advice, or you shouldn't cause a person to violate a different Torah requirement. But one of the examples is giving a person, you know, improper advice, like, and I think one of the examples that Rashi gives is you tell the person, here, why don't you sell your field, and you really have in mind that you really want to come back and buy it. So you're giving the person misleading advice, and that's a violation of putting a stumbling block in front of someone who's blind. So I hear what you're saying. It might be logical to apply that to this case, too. I didn't see anyone who does, but I understand the logic behind it. Thank you. Fine. So these two opinions that we saw, the Ritva and the Prisha, say that Kenevas Das, that the deception is biblically prohibited. The Smak, here in the next source, in source 6, disagrees, and he says that it's rabbinic. So he writes, there's another form of theft that the rabbis forbade, it's rabbinic, and that's deception. It is forbidden to deceive even an idolater. The sages say, do not steal even if it's just to irritate, like just to annoy someone. That is, one shouldn't say, I will steal a vessel from him so that he is pained by its loss. He'll notice it's missing and he'll be like, oh no, I lost my thing. And then he'll learn to take care of his property better, right? In the future, he'll be more careful with his property. So I'm almost trying to teach him a lesson. I snatch it from him, now he'll learn the lesson, he'll take better care of his property, right? And then I'll return it to him. So the Smak says that Kenevas Das, that deception is rabbinically prohibited. I was wondering if you could argue, I don't know if this is true or not, but the Smak mentions these two ideas in the same context, that first of all, one is not allowed to deceive, and second of all, one's not allowed to steal just to teach a person a lesson. So I was wondering, perhaps when a person steals to teach someone a lesson, they end up returning the object, the person doesn't lose anything monetarily. So they were tricked, but it caused them some suffering when they didn't know where their object was. But they didn't lose anything monetarily. So I'm wondering if the Smak, based on context, would say that when is it only rabbinically forbidden to deceive? That's when there's no monetary loss. But perhaps if there's a monetary loss, maybe then the smack would agree with the ritva and with the prisha, that then maybe it would be biblical, especially if the biblical prohibition is based on the verse not to steal. So it would make sense that any form of deception which leads to a monetary loss for the other person and a monetary gain for oneself, maybe then he would agree that that's biblical. So I'm not sure if that's true or not, but it's a possibility.
I don't even think this is fact.
What? I'm sorry?
This only has to be complete action for too long. It can't be just taking something and not refuting it. It never was a theft from the beginning.
That's interesting. Even in halacha, even in halacha, that's true. According to Rashi at the beginning of Maseches Sanhedrin, quotes a pasuk that says that he stole the spear. So it says that he actively stole the spear, and Rashi there says the same idea, that if a person defaults on a loan or something like that, that these things are okay, but that it wouldn't be what we would classify as theft in halacha either. I hear that. Fine, the next source here, source 7, is the Tosefta, and it just gives us an idea of the severity of deception, even in a case where there's no monetary loss. So Tosefta says there are 7 types of thieves. The first is one who deceives, right? This case of Ganevas Das. And an example of this is one who insistently invites his friend, knowing full well that his friend will decline the invitation and has no intention of really hosting him. Or one who sends many gifts to his friend, knowing that his friend will not accept them. One who does these things is considered as if he would deceive God if he had the ability. Anyone who deceives people is called a thief. So we see the severity of deception, even if there's no monetary loss. And then just a contemporary example of deception in business. This is in the context of false advertising. So it says here in source 8, in one case, an American company advertised that there's no laundry detergent that is better than ours. Let's pay attention to the exact wording. There's no laundry detergent that's better than ours. When it was proven that their detergent was no better than any other detergents, they lost the case, right? They were guilty of false advertising. Their claim that other detergents weren't any better than theirs, and that therefore they had not technically been dishonest, was not accepted, right? They just said, there's no laundry detergent that's better than ours. That's true. All the laundry detergents were exactly the same. So there was no laundry detergent which was better than theirs. Nonetheless, they still lost the case in false advertising, because it was clear that they intended to deceive the consumers. And the next thing I put on the source sheet is just a question that I wanted to ask you, because you know a lot more about the law and a lot more about these things than I do. So why aren't misleading financial statements considered to be false advertising? What's the legal definition of advertising? Meaning, if I want to sell my stocks, shares in my company at a higher price, so I present the company as if it's better than it really is, so let's say I do it in ways which are totally legal within accounting law, right? It's cases of creative accounting which are legal in terms of accounting law. But I'm still trying to mislead the customer, perhaps, by presenting the company as more valuable, so they'll buy stocks at a higher price. So why doesn't that qualify as false advertising? I'm not going to answer this question. I'm looking to you.
Why doesn't it constitute, under common law, why is that?
Yeah.
I mean, there are class action suits when companies' financial statements are misstated, for sure.
And is that based on false advertising?
It's based on the fact that there is intention to defraud.
Mm-hmm. And even though everything
I mean, you know, there is degrees, obviously. Like, there's a lot of subjectivity in combining the financial statements.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when you were talking about valuing assets, and you said, yeah, there could be a range of values, and any one of them could be better than the other, you know, so it's hard to say what is the appropriate figure to use.
Uh-huh. So, if I understand correctly, you're saying that it might not be necessary to have a false advertising claim against misleading financial statements, because they're covered anyways by other requirements, by regular accounting law.
There definitely is law where you could, you know, sue the company, sue the accountants, you know, for not presenting the financial statements.
Okay, cool. Thank you.
So that's good. You know what I mean? It wouldn't have to be under a false advertising.
I hear. So there are other laws that...
I'm not versed in this area of law, but clearly there has to be. Like, why that was a classic case, or, you know, it was deception, and it was class action lawsuits against the company and against the auditor's fault.
Yeah, I hear. Thank you. Thank you. What?
No.
Oh, okay, fine. So not only is there a prohibition against actively deceiving someone, but we see here in the Ramban in source 9 that there's also a requirement to go out of one's way to inform a buyer, right, lest they misunderstand. So the Ramban says here in source 9, the Torah is warning that they, the buyer and seller of a field, should know how many years are remaining until the Yovel year, right? The Yovel year is every 50 years is a Yovel year, and then all sales of land will return back to their original owner within Torah law. So the sale is based on how many years are remaining, and neither of them should trick the other with regard to the number of years. The seller should certainly not trick the buyer into thinking that the sale is permanent. They should both know, and they should inform the other of the number of years remaining to the sale. In other words, a seller can't just, you know, sit back and say, great, he's making a mistake, he doesn't realize how many years are left, he thinks he's getting the field for 30 years, he's just getting it for 15. I didn't say anything, it was just his mistake, so I'm just going to keep quiet. A person's not allowed to do that. They have to go out of their way to make sure that the person buying the field knows how many years he's getting the field for. Fine. So that was in general, these sources that were in general about the prohibition of deception. And now we're going to look into a few rationalizations that are given for in defense of creative accounting. And we're going to see some sources from Chazal and from the Torah that address those rationalizations. So just as a disclaimer before beginning, this article that we're going to keep referring to from Rabbi Gordon Cohn, where he gives these rationalizations for creative accounting, it's not that he's in favor of creative accounting or this negative form of creative accounting. He's just presenting rationalizations. But if you read through the article online, it's not like he's endorsing these things. He's just saying what a person might think. So he says here in Source 10, for example, so the first rationalization could be that I'm not personally tricking the buyer, right? I might, you know, be writing some type of misleading financial statement, but then someone else goes ahead and sells shares in the company. I'm not the one selling the shares in the company. So he says here in Source 10, for example, suppose a corporate accountant misrepresents earnings while someone else in the corporation sells the company's stock at an inflated price. The accountant might claim that only the actual seller of the new issue is guilty of the onah prohibition. So is that argument legitimate? So the Gemara tells us in Bava Metzia. Bava Metzia is the main Masechta which discusses these laws of Ona'ah, of not overcharging or underpaying. So the Gemara says here in Source 11, if water became mixed into one's wine, he may not sell it in his store unless he informs the customer. He may not sell it to a merchant, even if he does inform the merchant, because the merchant will use it to trick others. So even though he's not tricking others, he's just selling it to the merchant, since he knows that the merchant will go ahead and resell it, pretending that it's just 100% wine, not from concentrate, and since he knows that the merchant may likely do that, so he's not even allowed to sell it to the merchant. So presumably that would tell us then that this rationalization, that I'm not personally tricking the buyer of the stock, that someone else who actually sells the stock is the one who's tricking the buyer, presumably that's not a legitimate rationalization. Another possible rationalization here is that my involvement isn't so significant. There may be so many people, teams of people working together on the major company's financial statements, so they're going to do what they're going to do regardless of what I say. So what's wrong if I sort of do my part to that? So the Gemara tells us in Makos, here in Source 12, on the next page, Rabbi Akiva says, the third witness, meaning when the verse mentions a third witness, so it's not for leniency. Rather, it's to be strict with him and to apply to him the same rules would apply to the first two witnesses. In other words, in halakha, all you need is two witnesses to testify to something, and then we accept their testimony as truth. So you never need a third witness. So the Torah mentions if you'll have two witnesses or three witnesses. So why does it have to mention three witnesses? Why is a third witness mentioned there? So there were previous opinions in the Gemara which said that the third witness is mentioned for some form of leniency. But Rabbi Akiva disagrees, and he says that the third witness is mentioned in the pasuk, is mentioned in the verse, in order to teach us a stringency. And he says to teach us that the third witness is going to receive the same punishment as the original two witnesses if they were lying. If it was false testimony, not only are the first two witnesses punished, but the third witness also receives the same punishment. And if the Torah punishes those who Rabbi Akiva continues, and if the Torah punishes those who join sinners to the same extent as the sinners themselves, then certainly those who join those who do mitzvahs, who do good things, will be rewarded to the same degree as the primary people involved in the mitzvah. I just put that in because it's a nice, encouraging statement, that those who join people who do good get the same credit as the original people who came up with the idea to do that good thing. But And the bottom line is that the third witness, if they're testifying falsely, receives the same punishment as the first two. And Rashi here in Source 13 explains that the Torah is coming to be strict on him. One shouldn't say that without him, that without the third witness, the testimony would have been effective anyways. And therefore, he should not be punished with the standard rules of Hazama. Basically, the rule of Hazama is that witnesses who testify falsely, with certain exceptions, but in general, they receive the same punishment that they tried to impose on the defendant. So if they said the defendant has to pay $100, and it turns out that they couldn't possibly have known the defendant owes $100, because they were, I don't know, in a different country at the time, so they were testifying falsely, then they have to pay $100. So that's the rule of Hazama. And one might have thought that since the original two witnesses' testimony would have been effective without this third witness, maybe they shouldn't be liable. So the Torah teaches that even this third witness is one from amongst the group of witnesses, and he's just as liable as the other two are. So if there's a large group of people doing something wrong, and it's going to be done regardless of whether I personally join them or don't join them, it still would be forbidden to join them, and I can't rationalize myself by saying, well, they're going to do it anyways, what am I adding? It's still problematic because a group of three doing something, the third person is held accountable just like the first two, even though the first two could have done it themselves. Now, the example that we gave before of the person who's selling wine to the merchant and knowing that knowing full well that the merchant may go ahead and resell this wine which is diluted with water and pretend, the merchant might pretend when he sells it that it's wine that's not from concentrate. So that doesn't get taken to an extreme. And that we see in the Gemara here in Bava Metzia in Source 14. The Gemara tells us that they brought Rava wine that had been bought in the store. He diluted it with water to prepare it for his own drink and tasted it. It wasn't sweet. So he sent it back to the store. Presumably what that means is there's an idea of a mekaptos, a mistaken sale, that he thought that he was buying wine which was sweet wine. It was presented to him as sweet wine. It turned out it wasn't sweet wine, and so he said, this is not what I bought, and he sent it back for a refund. So Abaye asked, but haven't we learned that it may not be sold to a merchant even if he is informed? In other words, once you already mix the water back into it, so how can you go ahead and return it to the store? The store owner might go ahead and sell it to someone else and pretend that it's not from concentrate. So how can you do that, Rava? So Rava replied, my diluted wine is recognizable. Now, the Gemara tells us that he would add in a very specific amount of water into his wine, and you could tell by looking at it that it was diluted wine. And then he says, and if we should be concerned that the storekeeper will add more wine to sweeten it and then resell it, meaning maybe it's true, it's clear the way it is now that it's diluted with water. You can look at it, you can tell it's diluted with water, but maybe the store owner is going to pour in a little more wine so that it won't be, the percentage of dilution is not as great as it is now. So now there's more wine per water, and then I'll go ahead and resell it. So the Gemara says we don't have to be worried about that, because if so, the concerns will be endless. How do you know whenever you sell anything to anyone that they're not going to go ahead and do the same thing? So the bottom line is that as long as the object that's being returned or being given over to the merchant is one that cannot be used for trickery, so then even if he's capable of manipulating it in a way that he can then use it to deceive, so that's not my responsibility. So presumably the same thing would carry over, that if I'm presenting something, if I'm working on a statement and I'm presenting something which is honest and which is not intended to deceive, even though it could be then my work could be manipulated in some way by others and then used to deceive, that doesn't have to be my concern, because if so, everything could be my concern. So a person is only has to see to it that that what he's doing or what he's giving over to a merchant is not an object which can then be used for deception. Fine. So a few more rationalizations here that are presented by Rabbi Cohen in this article. So he says here in Source 15, third, the prohibition of Ona'a implies that an article was sold for more than fair value. And he quotes the Shulchan Aruch. In the classic case, value is determined by examining the competitive market price. For homogeneous goods, such as a bushel of wheat, the market price is readily available, right? We know what the price is. However, corporations have unique stock market prices which are not directly comparable. Thus, since a company's stock price has no readily available benchmark, its fair price cannot be established. An increase due to misleading information is not a violation of the Ona'a prohibition. In other words, how do we know how much the stock should be worth? It's true, the financial statements may be presented in a certain way and it may look like... Yes?
That's a contradiction. If you look at 11... compared with what it says.
It bought it and returned it. It's completely different. One has nothing to do with the other. So you can't sell it if you diluted it. He's returning a product which was affected and would give you more job.
The only thing is, I hear that, the only thing is that he diluted it with water before he returned it. Meaning if a person
right,
buys...
He's not telling back the story. The fact that the product is no good, he's giving it back. Like if I buy something, it's defective. I return the story. Do whatever I want to the product. There's no effect. It's, you're not doing... Mm-hmm. wasn't doing nothing. He was returning a product he bought that was defective. The first situation, the guy's actually diluting it, then selling it. It's completely different to sell and return something that's not
good. Right, so I hear the difference between the two cases. And I think it's also different, though, from a person who, in general, returns a defective item to the store, meaning if I just buy the object and return it to the store because it's defective, then there would be no question.
No,
but let's say...
Out. Let's say you try it out. That's what he did. He tried out the thing. You found, like, you're buying something at Costco. You test it. It's not working. It doesn't do what you want. You return it to Costco. You want to change it.
But let's say what I did to test out that product lowered its value in some way that wouldn't be recognizable.
It wouldn't make any difference. If you're returning it, if it didn't meet what you bought, you particularly said, I'm buying this. Mm-hmm. The product not meet what I was told it is. Whatever you did to the product doesn't matter. It has no effect.
Yeah.
Because you already bought on the intention that it would do what you said. And you already knew you were going to dilute it anyway.
Right.
It's completely different.
Right, so I think you're right in terms of my ability to return it to the store with regard to the rules of a mistaken purchase.
Right. So
however,
whether you put the water or not, it's still going to return to the store. It's not you. It's the store that might be an issue. Because you can do whatever you want with the product.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of my relationship with the store, I think you're correct. That even though I used it and that's the only way that I could tell that it was defective, I probably could still return it. But that's in terms of my relationship with the store. But perhaps I have to be concerned if I know that the store is going to put it back on the shelves and someone else is going to buy it.
Your duty is to inform the store, I put water in. That's your first. You don't have to do anything further than that. As long as you inform the store that you've put water into it or you diluted it, that's your responsibility. Again, the first case you're selling, if you have a responsibility of selling the product, you might store whatever the store's going to do. If I'm just returning what the store gave me and I diluted it, my only obligation is to inform the store that I diluted the product. There's zero application transfer.
So I wonder if there would be a difference between the laws, the legal aspect of that, and the halachic aspect of that. Meaning it could be that the law is as you're saying, and nonetheless, it could be that the halacha still requires a person to be concerned for the store owner putting it back on the shelves and the buyer...
Because they informed him about the water that he added to the wine, and he's it's up to the seller to decide. I mean, it's his problem and his responsibility. I don't think it's the buyer's.
I could hear how one could logically argue this on both sides.
I think the point made is that per halacha. Let's not talk about, we're looking at halacha.
Right.
If what you returned could not be distinguished from the product that's being sold,
right. There
is an issue, right?
Yeah, that's what it seems.
The reason it was distinguishable is that Rava is saying, when I returned it, it is distinguishable. What the merchant does afterwards, that's not my problem. But what the halacha is saying, from what I'm gathering, is if it isn't distinguishable, there is an issue.
There's no obligation.
Again, there is an obligation.
For halacha,
we're not talking about commercial transactions. Commerce is one thing. We're talking about halacha.
Mm-hmm.
Per halacha, if I'm understanding correctly, Rabbi,
is
that there is an issue. I do have to be concerned that the merchant may take my merchandise that isn't distinguishable from what he's generally selling and then resell it.
And then what difference would it be if he just took his own merchandise and put water in? What's the difference, yours or his? He can do the same thing with his.
Because I'm presenting.
It's insignificant. It doesn't matter.
We're trying to learn a point, right? So let's not...
Right.
The point is that, from what I'm gathering, is that if per halacha, I do have to be concerned about that situation.
I'm not getting that.
Right. Okay, I don't know the halacha l'masa, so if it becomes relevant, halacha l'masa, I guess everyone ask your own competent rabbi. But right. So we're not talking halacha l'masa, but it would seem from the sources that we're learning here that from a halachic perspective, one would have to be concerned about that, even if from a legal perspective, one would not. Yeah. Fine. So.
Excuse me.
Yes.
How far would you take your concern? Would you tell the store? I have a concern here because I'm bringing it to your attention, and I feel partly responsible. You make the store owner sign that he will do whatever pleases you, that he will give it back to the supplier or not put it back on the shelf. Like, how far can you take your concern?
I mean, it seems like if it's not, you know, recognizable, distinguishable, that it shouldn't be returned. That's what it seems like. Would it help to then ask the store owner to, you know, sign some type of promise and then based on that allow you to return it? I don't know. I'm not sure. It would sound like it's just a problem to return it.
Take on the loss.
Well, I guess one could ask, is it you who takes on the loss or is it the store that takes on the loss? Meaning it could be that if it's, you know, a faulty purchase, it could be that that's the store's loss, meaning maybe they have to reimburse me even without receiving the faulty object, you know, that they sold me. I'm not sure. I'm not sure who takes the loss, the store or the consumer, but it seems like there's a problem to return the object because it could be used for deception.
So where does the problem get solved? Like, where does everyone come out clean? Like, if I have to show concern that he is still in charge of a product that I returned, and I don't know what he's going to do with it, how do I sleep at night?
Well, it seems like there's a problem to return the object that he could use for deception. I'm not sure who takes the loss. I don't know if the person who bought it takes the loss. I would think, if I had to guess, just an educated guess, but I don't know, I would think that the store takes the loss. The store sold a faulty product. They have to reimburse me for what I paid for their faulty product, despite the fact that I'm not going to provide him with a product that he can then use to deceive other people. I'm not sure if that's true, because I understand the storekeeper is going to say, well, one second, I'd rather have, you know, wine that's not sweet and that's diluted with water than not have anything at all. If I'm reimbursing you what you paid, I should at least be entitled to the object back. So that I hear that on both sides. I'm not sure. I have to look into that question, who takes the loss. But it seems from here that it can't be returned to the storekeeper. I'm just wondering now, I'm just thinking out loud, in a different context, there are halachos about how damaged a coin can be, to allow one to still use it. Because in the old days, the coins had value based on their size and their metallic value, right? So how damaged can the coin be to still be used? And there are different parameters for will people be misled by it or not. So I'm just wondering if it could be a solution to in some way do something to the object to make it recognizable that it's damaged or whatever, and then return it in some way which doesn't damage it further. Because that could be a solution to make everyone happy. You know, it's like on Shabbos when you want to have a full loaf of bread for your Lecha Mishnah. So on Shabbos we have two loaves of bread and we want them to be whole. So what happens if someone had a little piece? So what I usually do is I just break it entirely in half, just so that it's clear that it's been used. You know, it's already been used, so it's not considered a whole loaf anymore. But a person might not notice, so I just split it in half to make it noticeable. It's not any less valuable than it is if you just took off one little piece. So maybe there's some way that you can make it recognizable that it's different without causing any further damage to it, and then you could return it to the store. I'm not sure. But I guess this is probably a topic for a whole additional shiur. So I think I'm going to leave this for now. But they're important questions to figure out because they can come up all the time. So yeah. And just an interesting question on that, which I don't want to get into. But my wife bought a coat for one of the kids. And then found out there was some type of mistake or whatever it is, and I didn't think they didn't charge us enough. So my wife called to pay the full amount, and they said, "I'm sorry, we can't take the payment over the phone. You have to come into the store." And the store was like 20 minutes away. So then the question became, "Listen, I'm happy to pay them over the phone, and I'm happy to pay them." But can they insist that I then travel all the way back to the store, spend the 20 minutes going each way, spend 40 minutes to pay them the rest? So, sometimes you have a situation where, someone's going to lose out. There's just, I don't know, I don't want to get into that now. I'm just thinking out loud, but I'm getting too far afield. Fine, back to our topic. So, fine. So this argument was that, this is the third argument, I'm just going to read it inside again here in Source 15. Third, the prohibition of onah implies that an article was sold for more than fair value, as the Shulchan Aruch writes, Rabbi Kato of the Shulchan Aruch. In the classic case, value is determined by examining the competitive market price. For homogeneous goods such as a bushel of wheat, the market price is readily available. However, corporations have unique stock market prices which are not directly comparable. Thus, since a company's stock price has no readily available benchmark, its fair price cannot be established. An increase due to misleading information is not a violation of the onah prohibition. So can we argue that way? Can we say that since there's no official price for a company's stock, so therefore it's not misleading to make it seem like the company is more valuable than it really is and have the buyers pay more for the stocks, because maybe that higher price is really what the stock is worth. Who's to say that the stock is worth the lower price? So the Gemara says here in source 16, the laws of onah do not apply to real estate. Now there's a whole discussion as to why that is. The laws of onah again are referred to overcharging by more than a sixth. So one is allowed to sell land for more than a sixth of its quote-unquote value. There's a whole discussion as to why that is. Is that because you can't really determine a price for land? Or is that it's a gzeiras hakasuv, it's just that's what the Torah says, and you know, we don't have necessarily a reason for it, but that's the way it is. So, but one possibility that's discussed is that people sometimes pay more for land than its quote-unquote market value. So the Gemara says that the laws of onah do not apply to real estate, but that is only when it is divided, if you're talking about a division between partners or between inheritors, but that's only when it's divided based on value. If it's divided based on measurements, then the sale of the division is invalidated if it's mistaken. As Rabbah says, anything that is measured, weighed, or counted, even if it is mistaken by only a small amount, it's invalidated. So perhaps one could argue that the same thing would apply to stocks. That even if stocks don't have a set value, just like land, you could argue doesn't have a set value. Nonetheless, that's only if you say, okay, I'm selling you the land, and you give the proper measurements, and you say you're selling it for a price which is, you know, more than a sixth of what one would have thought is its fair market value. But if one says that it's, you know, it's an acre bigger than it really is, so then the sale is not a sale. Then the sale is disqualified. So perhaps you could argue so too when it comes to describing the value of a company, to creating financial statements for a company. So if the statements are incorrect, so then even though it's hard to figure out the exact value of what the stock price, the fair market value of the stock should be, it doesn't matter. If the sale is mistaken because of misinformation, it's still going to be a problem of onah. And then the fourth rationalization, going back here to source 15, picking up from the paragraph beginning fourth. Fourth, onah implies that the buyer was hurt by the merchant's actions. One can argue the stock purchaser's dominant interest is not whether a share of the company is worth what she's paying, rather her consideration is if her investment will be profitable. The buyer wants to estimate the true value of the company only to the extent that true value is a predictor of shares appreciation. The investor may be indifferent to misrepresented accounting earnings increasing to misrepresented accounting earnings increasing the stock price, as long as the price will not collapse to its quote-unquote true value. Kaplan and Roll and Hand, for example, claim that stock prices rise as a result of misleading accounting earnings. However, according to the analysis, only if the artificially inflated price eventually falls is there a transgression of the onah prohibition. So the argument is that the buyer actually doesn't care what the fair price of the stock is, as long as next week it goes up, and as long as next month it doesn't go down. So is that a legitimate argument? So for the sake of time, we're just going to skip a whole bunch of sources here because they're actually quite complicated and detailed. But the bottom line is, and we'll see here in the Shulchan Aruch, in source 21, the Shulchan Aruch writes, there's a machlokes between Rashi and the Shita Mekubetzes in terms of understanding a particular case in the Gemara where a person wants to mix new grain into old grain. So the understanding is that older grain, that aged grain, is more valuable, but that people sometimes prefer new grain because they intend to store the grain for a longer period of time. And if they buy the aged grain and store it for a longer period of time, then eventually it will become, you know, become worth less. So people might want to buy the new grain because they plan on storing it, despite the fact that the aged grain is more valuable. So Rashi and Shita Mekubetzes argue about whether the case in the Gemara is where a person is mixing in new grain into his aged grain, and the question, there's a machlokas in Rashi and the Shita Mekubetzes as to whether what he's trying to do is put use less valuable produce to fill up the volume of what he has to sell. So rather than selling a lot of what's more valuable, sell a little of what's more valuable and mix in some cheaper goods you know, in between. That's how Rashi understands the Gemara. And the Shita Mikubetzes understands the Gemara that the person is trying to put the more valuable grain on top to trick the buyer into thinking that he's getting, you know, an entire, you know, the entire barrel is more valuable grain. So difference of opinion how to read the Gemara. But the bottom line here in source 21 in the Aruch HaShulchan, so he says here, sometimes the buyer prefers new grain, even if the aged grain is better, because he wants to store them. And sometimes the buyer prefers old grain, even if a different grain is more valuable. And therefore, a person has to sell what he says that he's selling, and he can't say, well, maybe I'm really doing him a favor, I'm putting in grain that's more valuable. Or maybe I'm really doing him a favor, I'm putting in grain which he can store for longer, and most people like storing grain for longer. A person can't do that. He has to sell what he actually says that he's selling. So I think if we could apply that back to our case, a person who's paying a higher stock price than the stock is really worth. But one would argue that, well, he doesn't care as long as it goes up next week. So I have no right to assume that he wants to keep these stocks for one day a week, a month, the next century. I don't have a right to assume that he's going to sell it at its higher value before it goes down and when people realize that the price was just inflated in the first place. So a person can't argue, well, he doesn't care, he's going to sell it in a month and he's going to make money, he's going to be happy, he doesn't care what the price is. Maybe the guy has in mind to hold on to it for 50 years, just like the person has in mind to hold on to the new grain, and therefore a person has to sell the grain that they say they're going to sell. Okay, moving on to the next potential rationalization, that the buyer can evaluate the company himself and determine for himself. Now, first of all, it's probably not practical. The reason why people have accountants is because they need accountants, not because anyone who wants to can just figure out what the company is worth on his own. So it's probably not relevant, but even if it were relevant, so the Gemara says here in source 22, it's talking about mixing different types of wine, and just for the sake of time, the last line here in source 22 is that this is the opinion of Rabbi Acha, who allows it in the case where it is tasted. When the wine will be tasted and the person will find out what it is, so then it's allowed, and that's explained here in source 23 in the Shulchan Aruch, where the Shulchan Aruch says that in a location where anyone who buys tastes the wine first, then it's always permitted to mix. But if not everyone tastes, it's forbidden. In other words, you can't say the guy could figure out if he wants to. It has to be that it's customary that everyone, before making the deal, is for sure going to investigate fully. And that's certainly not the case. The last potential rationalization here, and for the sake of time, we're going to rush through it, is the argument that, well, everyone does it, so buyers who buy stocks expect that that the statements might be, you know, portrayed in the best light possible, even if, you know, they were stretched a little bit. So the Gemara says here in source 24 that a merchant may take from 5 granaries or 5 wine presses and put them all in one storehouse, provided that he doesn't intend to mix in order to deceive. And Rashi in source 25 explains that the merchant may take from 5 granaries because everyone knows that the produce didn't grow in his fields and that he purchased it from many people, and they buy from him knowing that that's the case. And nonetheless, Rashi continues, provided that he doesn't intend to mix and to advertise as if he buys the majority and to advertise it as if he buys the majority from a better place and then mixes in from another place, with his neighbors believing that all the produce was bought from the better place. So even if we say that everyone knows that he buys from multiple farmers, that's only if his intention is not to deceive. If his intention is to deceive, it's still going to be a problem. Even in a case where something is technically not halachically a problem, we see that there's also an idea for a person to hold themselves to a higher standard, and that we see here in source 26 and 27. Let's just skip to 27, because they basically say the same thing. 27, the Shulchan Aruch says, one may not inflate the innards of an animal so that they will appear larger, and one may not soak the meat in water so that it will appear whiter and fatter. If the custom of all the butchers is to do this, and everyone knows that this is the customary practice, that this is the common practice, there are those who allow it because there is no ona'ah. And nonetheless, he writes in parentheses, one who guards himself, meaning i.e. he holds himself to a higher standard, will distance himself from this because there is concern that the buyer will really think that the meat is fatty, because there is fatty meat available. And that's in fact why all the butchers have this practice. In other words, it's for the sake of deceiving. And therefore, it's a person who, even if you would argue that it's technically legitimate, a person should hold themselves to a higher standard and should not do it. An argument is given for this by the next source here, the Divrei Malkiel, which is written by Rav Tannenbaum, who lived in the late 19th century in Poland. So he writes here in source 28, logically it would seem to me that this should be forbidden. The prohibition is primarily because of deception, because the leanness of the meat won't be noticeable. So why should it be permitted just because it's customary? When decorating a person or an object, when he's talking about decorating a person here, he's not referring to putting on makeup. No one says that that's a problem. He's referring to in the old days where there actually were servants. It's a whole topic for a different shiur about how exactly the concept of a servant worked. Of course, there were halachos as to how one had to take care of their servant, etc. But that's a topic for a different shiur, especially since it's not relevant nowadays anyways. But so when decorating a person or an object, it's obviously prohibited, even if one can tell that it's been decorated. And he gives a reason why. He says this is because it's not recognizable exactly how less valuable it really is. Meaning a person who sees it doesn't know what he's buying. So that itself is a problem. There's an example of this idea that, you know, everybody knows, so it's not deception. When it comes to the halachos of delivering a eulogy, the Beis Yosef here quotes the Ramban in source 29, and he writes, the Ramban writes that one may not exaggerate excessively in a eulogy. Rather, one may praise the deceased according to his honor, and slightly more, as is the way of those who praise. So it sounds like, if this is a normal way that people, you know, praise either a person in the eulogy, or, you know, perhaps one could extrapolate to other cases, so then it would be okay. But not so fast, because the Taz explains this differently. The Taz here in source 30 says, one may exaggerate slightly. This is difficult. What's the difference between a small lie and a big lie? So he says, perhaps the explanation is the following. It's reasonable to assume that one who does a mitzvah to a certain degree would certainly have done the mitzvah to a greater degree if that were to have been necessary. For example, if a poor person asked for a certain amount of charity and the person gave it to him, he presumably would have given slightly more if that would have been what the person needed. It is therefore considered as if he did slightly more, and it's not considered to be a lie. And the Bach also interprets it differently than what we originally thought here in source 31. Since it's forbidden to minimize the praise of the deceased. In other words, you can't praise him less than he deserves. That's actually a halachic problem. A eulogy has to be, you know, to the proper extent. So therefore, they therefore permitted exaggerating slightly. If it would have been forbidden to exaggerate slightly, there would be concern that they might, God forbid, listen to the strength of the way he says it, there'd be concern that they might, God forbid, not praise the deceased sufficiently. So because, you know, something had to give in either direction, they said you could exaggerate slightly. But we can't really learn out from this halacha that whenever it's expected that we're going to praise something more than it's really worth, or praise a person more than they really deserve, that therefore it's okay, because it's explained differently by the Taz and the Bach. Just to conclude, there is an idea that a person is allowed to present merchandise in a positive light. So it says here, in source 31, the merchant may beautify his merchandise. This is when he doesn't trick the buyer. Instead, he presents the merchandise in an appealing way. He can create a positive impression if it is true. It is permitted to paint a new vessel. In other words, you can't paint an old vessel to make it look like it's new and deceive someone, but if it's new, you can paint it. This is the way of the world, to present merchandise in a nice way so long as nothing is being hidden. One who sells or rents a house will plaster it in order to sell it for a good price. Sellers will package their goods in a nice wrapping. The Mishnah says in Eruchin that a servant dressed in a nice garment worth 30 zuz can then be sold for an additional 100 zuz. This is permitted, and there are boundaries between beautifying and deceiving. So a person is allowed to present their merchandise in a positive way, provided that it's honest. So just to conclude with the disclaimer that I said at the beginning, everyone here knows a lot more about law and a lot more about accounting than I do. This is just to see some of the Torah sources as a starting point, and nothing that we said is halacha l'maaseh, so everyone should apply the halacha to their particular cases. I'm sure there's so many nuances that it's not really possible to discuss everything, but at least this is a start. So.